Episode of Progress, Potential, and Possibilities, discussions with fascinating people designing a better tomorrow for all of us. I'm your host, Ira Pastor.
Welcome, everybody, again to another episode of our show, bringing you another really great guest today involved in creating a better tomorrow for millions of people out there. Today, we have the honor of being joined by Dr. Mariangela Simoe, who is a director, president of the All for Health Institute, also in Portuguese, known as Instituto Todos pela Saúde. It's a nonprofit organization based in Sao Paulo that focuses on outbreaks, epidemic and pandemic preparedness in support of the global Brazilian health system. Dr. Simoe is also a member of the supervisory board of the Access to Medicine Foundation, which is an organization that works to stimulate and guide the pharmaceutical industry to ultimately do more for people living in low and middle income countries, and recently became a member of the Science and Technology Expert Group of the G7's International Pandemic Preparedness Secretariat. Dr. Simoe attended medical school in Brazil with degrees in pediatrics and public health, also received a master's in public health located on mother and child health at the University of London in the UK, and she has worked with Brazil's public health system since the early 1980s, from primary health care to a series of various managerial positions throughout the years. Between 2006 and 2010, she worked for the Ministry of Health in Brazil as the director of the Department of Sexually Transmitted Diseases and AIDS. She also worked for the UN Program for HIV and AIDS, or UNAIDS, as director for prevention, gender, community mobilization, and human rights for 7 years, and then most recently was assistant director general for access to medicines and health products at the WHO in 2017 to 2022. We're honored to have her with us today, Dr. Mariangela Simoe. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show today.
Thank you, Irene. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today.
It's wonderful having you. I would love to start off by handing you the floor for a little bit, just to talk and introduce a little bit more about you, especially to our audience up here in the United States. If you could sort of take us back a bit to everything from, you know, where you grew up, why you decided on medicine, and what took you into pediatrics initially. I think that'd be a great way to start off.
Thank you. That's going back to the past, right? Actually, I joke lately that I'm part now of a group that has more past than future, you know, because as we get older, maybe wiser or maybe not wiser. But anyway, I grew up, I was born in Curitiba, which is a town, capital of the state of Paraná in the south of Brazil. You know, and I'm the fourth child of a 5-children family. Now families are smaller, but I'm almost the youngest of a large family, and I actually decided to do medical school was a strange decision, because all my life, when I was a child and when I was a teenager, I wanted to do astronomy. You know, and my mother took me to Rio, where they had this physics course with an astronomy background and so on. And then I was an exchange student to the U.S. I was in New Jersey for a year.
Yeah.
You know, and I came back, I really liked dealing with people, you know, so I decided to do psychology. And I had an uncle who was a psychiatrist, and he said, no, don't do psychology. Go for a medical degree. You can do a medical degree. I ended up doing pediatrics and doing public health afterwards. And that's basically, I got married early, was married for 40 years. Then I had two children that are now adults. And I'm a widow for 5 years now.
It's a fascinating journey that you've been on to date, of course. I took a look back, again, I'm very interested in sort of everything you've been doing. I looked at a lot of your sort of early publications in public health and in various areas like health services, family health, maternal health. And then, it was around the turn of the millennia that, the topics of sexually transmitted diseases, AIDS, and then, of course, maternal and child mortality prevention sort of come into your research papers and the things you're writing about. This is an area that for the few times I've profiled it on the show, I've always been extremely shocked by the numbers. When we look at the amount of women that die every day from preventable childbirth related complications, the amount of babies that die every day. And here we are in 2024, and it's one of those areas, even though I came up in the pharmaceutical industry, I thought we had control over this. And I would love just to talk a little bit about, because obviously you studied this area specifically when you were doing your work in London. Talk a little bit about this area from what you saw originally, and then sort of where we are in 2024.
You know, Ira, it's very interesting because you see a lot of pediatricians in public health because I know like the social determinants of health, they become very critical when you're growing up in early ages, mostly, right? And this what we call this inequality starts when the mother becomes pregnant, right? So in principle, all maternal deaths are preventable, in principle. But that's not what happens, right? So that's a you have different outcomes. Once in a while, you have a high income mother who dies of causes related to pregnancy, but it's extremely rare. You know, so it's common to have younger mothers, poorer the social economic strata, and not very educated and so on. So you with difficulty in access to healthcare. So this is in principle something that we that work in public health need to be always on the lookout, you know, to provide because every pregnancy ends up either on an abortion of some kind induced or how do you say spontaneous, right? Or it will end up in on a birth, live birth or not stillbirth or whatever. You know, so it's something that you can, those who are in the planning of healthcare, they can plan. You know, because you know how many women get pregnant every year, you know how many women will go. Statistically, it's very well known, even in less developed countries, it's very well known how many women will get pregnant. So I'll cite the experience we had in my hometown because
Please.
Curitiba has a very, Brazil has a national health system, you know, that's instituted by the Constitution and by specific laws and so on. So it covers nowadays 75% of the population. It's universal health coverage. And in some areas of Brazil, it's more than 90% of the population, right? So when we in my hometown, what we're trying to bring down the infant mortality rate. Okay, infant mortality, you register all live births and you divide it by 1,000 live births. You know, so you know how when you say like 30 infant mortality, 30 per 1,000, 30 children died of below 1 year of age. Okay, so this is the infant mortality rate. So in my hometown, we are trying to bring down the infant mortality to one digit. You know, we are like 15, so which was not, it was very low for Brazil. Not low enough, but it was low for Brazil. So where did we go? We went to the antenatal care. You know, we looked at the antenatal care because when a woman gets pregnant, she needs to know where she's going to give birth. No, Brazil, it's highly hospitalized. I mean, 99% of the births are in hospital settings. You know, so we started to do that, you know, to ensure that she was identified early by the health system so that you could identify where and high risk pregnancy, either for herself or for the baby, unborn baby, and who were and so capture them early, keep them in the system so that they should come every month and so on, and make sure they had a proper delivery at the proper level of care, right? So if you had a high-risk pregnancy, you should go to a specialized hospital. And I'm saying this because when we start doing this was when HIV was hitting hard in Brazil, you know, and we already knew that there were measures that we could prevent mother-to-child transmission. You know? So we started testing. This was early 1990s, probably. We started to test the pregnant ladies for HIV during antenatal care. So we married we put together several pieces of decreasing maternal mortality, decreasing the chances of a mother dying because of the pregnancy, of having decreasing infant mortality, and ensuring that HIV positive mothers had access to proper antenatal care, and that their babies could access the medication that was available at the time. No, so all these things are still a big challenge.
Sure.
Not so much in Brazil, but in many, many countries in the world, we see the challenge of making sure that the women get pregnant when they want to. No, because another factor is teenage pregnancy is a big, big issue for public health, right? And making sure they have the proper care and to avoid preventable diseases, and that they deliver healthy babies. So,
you brought up HIV, and I know, you know, in your you know, publications, HIV sort of becomes an extremely important theme for you. And, you know, you're publishing on universal access and surveillance. You're even writing a little bit about the dual prevention programs, you know, between HIV, tuberculosis. And, you know, we talked to Dr. Gedahun at WHO about that last year. In 2012, you're part of this big expose sort of in the Journal of HIV. It's entitled Engaging to End the Epidemic, Seven Essential Steps Towards an AIDS-Free Generation. And you specifically author this one part, Scaling Up HIV Treatment and Prevention Through Bold National Responses, Innovative Leadership. And here, you know, you give examples, not just of what you're doing in Brazil at the time, but, you know, you look at other countries, Uganda, Nigeria, India. Talk a little bit about this period, because I'd love to, you know, sort of get your perspective of what was going on. But at the same time, obviously, PEPFAR is happening as well. And would love to, because we had the ambassador on a couple of months ago talking about PEPFAR, a little bit of your perspective from sort of Brazil's angle with regard to that specific program and helping, you know, again, create this AIDS-free generation that we all want.
Yeah, you know, you're citing a lot of my publications, but most of my life was dedicated to public health, not from an academic perspective, because the publications were a sideline, right? A product of what I was doing most of my professional life. But you cited PEPFAR also, right?
Yeah.
And I had to be I'll give a testimony, you know, to the importance of PEPFAR. The funding and the work it's done in countries, you know? And I particularly like the way it was kept throughout the years with a very technical focus of increasing access, you know, to treatment and access to diagnosis and to prevention measures and everything. There are ups and downs with PEPFAR. There are periods where there was like. There were difficulties with like promoting abstinence, which is proven that doesn't work. It was proven later on, and 2012 was a hot year for this type of things. But they were great things, and I'd like to go a little bit back, because I always cite, you know, when you compare the COVID pandemic right now and the HIV pandemic, and you see. I keep saying here in Brazil, and when I speak internationally as well, we keep committing the same mistakes every time, you know, because for HIV, we had like 10 years left before access was becoming common in high-income countries, and when access was being started in low-income, in developing countries in general, except Brazil, it was already more accepted. So I think 2012, 2000, until 2015, we were on in the years of pushing for, if you have an innovation or if you have a medication, you have drugs that will help people to live better and longer, they should be available everywhere. You know, it shouldn't matter whether you're born in a rich country from well-to-do parents or if you're born in a poor country in a difficult situation, you know. So this is, it's always this equity and on health was on access to health services and to products. It became a mantra of the HIV response, a lot to do with activism and people, not only people from civil society organizations who were most at risk, but also of vulnerable groups, but key populations, but also from health professionals like myself and other people you have already interviewed, who dedicated part of their life to ensuring that access to the technologies that were existing somewhere else should be available for those who did not access them. And the situation has changed a lot since PEPFAR and since the Global Fund and so on in many countries. But we are also seeing, if I may, we are seeing a resurgence in some countries of more punitive laws regarding, you know, because we all now, we do have some people, not all people are equal, right? And some people have more needs than others, right? Like you have sex workers criminalized in more than 100 countries. We have same-sex relationship or a same-sex acts criminalized and with punitive laws that go up to death penalties in some countries. So this is all, this all creates more vulnerability for some people to acquire HIV in a time when we are seeing really major gains in terms of life expectancy and everything else. So it's the work is not done.
But yeah, as you're saying, you made you know, major headway in terms of the antiretrovirals. You know, during that time, obviously we still need to do better on that front. But then I, you know, I also found it interesting, you know, when I think of the term access and some of your work, obviously the antiretrovirals were part of it. But again, and I'm sorry, I keep going back to your publications. I found them quite interesting. You know, you've also written on antimicrobial resistance, which is, okay, in this area where we have drugs, but they're not working anymore. And then a sort of third thing that was kind of interesting, because I also did some profiling on sort of the this Lomé initiative in Africa on sort of the substandard and fraudulent drugs that are out there. And I think all of this, it all comes together in a very interesting way that whether it's the drugs we don't have yet or improving the existing ones, we have to have innovation. And so I would love to, you know, go to, I guess, you know, your January 2020 British Medical Journal entitled "Can Affordability and Innovation Coexist?" And here, you know, you go into your learnings in terms of, you know, broadly about what you think about innovation in developing countries. Talk a little bit about this, because I think all three of these problems, access, the antimicrobial resistance problem, and fraudulent drugs, you know, sort of have an epicenter that of innovation solving these problems one day, but take us into this area, if you would.
Yeah, of course. You know, the substandard and falsified drugs, which were called in the past fake drugs or something, right? They have different, because in the beginning, when we started moving towards a more robust, quality assured generic production, you know, there are some countries who were naming or some countries who were creating restrictions and saying that generic drugs were fake drugs or substandard and or falsified drugs, which is a very, it was created a maybe 2014, 15, a big political momentum because of that. Now, NWGO had a lot of work and had working groups and on on fighting substandard and falsified drugs, which mostly are related to antibiotics and malaria drugs. You see, drugs that are important because they save lives. You know, so you see a whole market, but the world is much there are global alerts right now and so on. Now, so it's a separate issue. The substandard and the generic production, they are separate issues from innovation, you
Okay.
know, and access, right? Because then you have different issues coming into play. One, I think we had a landmark case that most people will remember, which was the treatment cure for hepatitis C, right? Sofosbuvir, it's a drug that manufactured by the US producer who came into market at the US for $1,000 per pill. And you needed 3 months, you know? So at this time, we were discussing in WHO and elsewhere, we were discussing what's a fair price. You know, what is a price that if you have something that can, it's a life changer, a game changer, like an antiviral that cures a chronic disease that's a, sorry, terrible disease, hepatitis C. And you, what is, it's like it's a global good, right? Something that will save lives for sure. So how do you make sure that it's put out there at a fair price, right? A price in what, how do you find and define a fair price? It's a price that people don't go bankrupt because they have to pay for it, or that governments can buy. Right? So like in the case of my country, it's governments have the government has to buy constitutionally. So in the years I was at the World Health Organization, we had a very good partnership with the World Trade Organization because intellectual property rights are managed by the World Trade Organization. And also there's the patent organization internationally as well, right? And one of the issues that we're talking, and even it was the Director General of the World Trade Organization once spoke at one of our seminars, was that an innovation that sits in the shelves because no one can pay for it, it's useless for the producer, it's useless for the patients, you know. So we need to find a balance. And once someone, and so we start talking about fair price, fair profits, how do you balance? And I think this is a big issue in the US, big issue in developed countries in general. And then someone told me, you should not talk about a fair profit or a fair price. You should talk about a sustainable return on investment, right? Which is a, it's a nice way to put it. And anyway, it's also, it's a good way to put it. After that, we issue, I was still at the WHO, a report on the cancer pricing. You know, and it was you know, because you end up not knowing how much does it cost to put that companies spend on research and development because it's a black box, right? You don't know how much it costs. So at WHO, we did analyze 20 years after how much each company had publicly profited from each of these oncology drugs. And it was amazing, you know, the margins of profit that we envisaged that happened. So I'm not talking against profit because I think innovation has to be rewarded, you know, but I'm talking about health products that will change the life of people. I'm not talking about obesity drugs, although obesity, sometimes morbid obesity, is a disease, but you know, but not for aesthetic reasons, but drugs that can save people's lives, they should be available wherever they're needed and at a price that the governments can't afford. So that's how I see innovation in health. You know, it's super welcome, and I'm a big fan of innovation. The innovation that proves to be efficacious, that proves to be effective, and that's sustainable. It has affordable prices.
Let's talk about ITPS because it seems that you are, in essence, as I mentioned in the beginning, broadly looking at epidemiological surveillance systems, looking at some of the new technologies in terms of genomics and other tools to analyze data that tells us, God forbid, what is coming our way in terms of potential pandemics. And it's interesting because you mentioned obviously the coronaviruses and so forth, but at the same time, Brazil is a tropical country and has also a variety of the neglected tropical diseases that we discussed. I know dengue is a big interest of yours. Introduce us a bit to the organization and a little bit about what your responsibility as director president involves,
A big
what your
title,
typical
right?
day is like. Yeah, exactly.
It's called in Portuguese Instituto Todos pela Saúde, and
I
it's
pronounced it
actually,
poorly, but
you pronounce my name right, so it's okay.
there we go.
No, the All In for Health Institute is a nonprofit that's funded by the largest Latin American banking conglomerate,
Okay.
Itaú Unibanco. It's funded why? Because during the pandemic, Brazil was in such a mess, as much of the world, but Brazil has a strong national health system, tradition produces vaccines, so it was producing that, but it was a big mess. So the bank at the time put 1 billion reais, which is maybe 200, $250 million. Put into to support governments in Brazil at state, federal, and city levels to fight the pandemic. For example, putting oximeters in all primary health care units, that kind of thing, or helping with training, hiring people from major health hospitals and helping with training in intensive care for patients with respiratory disease, grave, severe. So it was a variety of inputs, and it was the biggest ever philanthropic funding to the national health system ever,
Excellent.
And from this experience, the bank, one of the families that owned the bank, they decided to institutionalize, to create an institute. And that this institute has an endowment, and it works in supporting the government on outbreaks, epidemics, and pandemic, right? Because an outbreak turns into an epidemic, which is not, if it's not checked, turns into a, may turn into a pandemic. For example, Brazil right now is on, has, there's a huge, the Americas in general, Latin America mostly, in the Caribbean, a huge dengue epidemic, right? So what do we do, right? We help, and I always say, we need to do now, prepare the ground for whatever comes next. For example, if you have like dengue is re-emerging, it appears every 4 or 5 years. It's every year, but every 4 or 5 years, there's a big outbreak. We call it an epidemic. We are started last year. We are going through it right now. So what do we need to know? We need to know what type of virus is circulating. Dengue has four types, right? So we help with sequencing, we help labs, that kind of thing. We keep a very good partnership with the private labs network, which complements the information by the state-owned labs. So we do monitoring of the arbovirus, dengue, chikungunya, Zika, because Brazil does not only have Zika, dengue, right? Has Urucuxi, which is another, like Manaus, we were seeing that there was very little positivity for dengue, and it was another virus, was Urucuxi. So the institute is here to help establish the conditions for whenever a new pathogen or an re-emerging pathogen comes in, that the government knows it's there, in a timely manner and that it helps the surveillance of the disease. So that's what we do right now. You know? So we work with a range of institutions and we don't do things ourselves. We manage the processing.
Excellent.
But genomic sequencing is a very strong part for us, you know, because that's what we did mostly during the pandemic. And and Brazil does have a good structure infrastructure, but it's very divided. You know, it's not integrated enough. So
it's
go ahead.
Please, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Good.
No, I was going to say that you need to have the diagnosis first, and you need to know what type of virus or whatever is circulating.
Absolutely.
Quickly, not a month from now.
Angel, can you say a few words about the relationship with Itaú Unibanco? Because I, from what I was reading, it's kind of a very unique financial relationship that we haven't really seen before.
Yeah, you know, Ira, it's very good to see this kind of investment in health where there are no strings attached. You know, like during the pandemic when all the was chaotic in Brazil, they put together, the bank put together the president of the council of the bank. He put together a group of public health people who guided how the money was going to be spent, you know. And now with the institute, they don't say it. They sit on our advisory board or on our administrative board, actually, not advisory, and they give their opinion, but they don't interfere with the management. And this is different because from my experience with funders in general, especially the big funders internationally, they have an agenda and they tell you, you know, you can do X, Y, Z if you want my money, you know. And our relationship with Itaú Unibanco is very different. They tell us, what do you need to do? You know, what needs to be done for this to happen? So it's a new type of relationship, which is good for public health and it's good for the public in general.
Yeah, it's outstanding, and obviously deferring to experts like yourself in public health. So that's great to see that model in place. Kind of feeds into, of course, what you're doing now. Also, with all these responsibilities that I mentioned in the bio of the show, that amongst what you know, you're running ITS, but also you have been elected to this science and technology expert group for this, you know, 100 days mission. And again, you know, part of this is sort of, you know, setting up the appropriate countermeasures, innovation, so that as sort of that basket of things that took a little while, just sequencing, testing, repurposing of drugs, vaccine development, and so forth, no matter what comes our way, happens faster and efficiently. Could you talk a little bit about this particular organization? Obviously, your responsibilities in the expert group. You got a great team of partners there. You know, Victor Zell, Rick Bright from BARDA, Jan Arnott again from Wellcome Trust. What's it all about, and what are you going to be proposing specifically from the Latin American angle?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, Ira, because I always say there are things that you need to do in your own country.
Yeah.
You know, that needs to be done, like reinforcing, strengthening the national health system, the surveillance system, the lab network. You need to do it. Now, and there are other things like the innovative aspects of the health products, new vaccines that needs to be shared internationally. And then the International Pandemic Preparedness Secretariat, which is housed by the Wellcome Trust in the UK, right? And it's an excellent platform because it brings scientists from different areas, and we're trying to keep track of what's being developed by different virus families, four different virus families.
Mm-hmm.
Because why did we have a vaccine? An mRNA vaccine so fast last time with the SARS-CoV-2 or the other platforms, right? Because there are several platforms, because there was already research ongoing, you know, so it didn't come out of nowhere. You know, it was already there and it was repurposed or redirected to this coronavirus, the SARS-CoV-2. Right? So we need to create the same situation, thinking of the different, potentially the what we WHO calls is the priority pathogen list.
Yep.
You know, so this expert group and this organization in the UK, where there are several people in the expert group, we are looking at these different possibilities in how do you foster the research and development, and you create the basis. Once you have something that is affecting the world or part of the world heavily, how do you make sure there's enough production that 100 days, you know, that you have a product that's both safe and efficacious, right? And then that you have it available to more countries, you know, to countries. And this is what we're doing at IPPS, right? It's a similar acronym because I'm running the IPPS in Brazil, Todos
right,
Pés,
right.
And the other is the IPPS. But this is the work, you know, and brings together private sector, academics, researchers, public health authorities like myself. You know, that kind of thinking that if something hits, we need to be better prepared. But at the same time that we have this international secretariat preparing the ground, we do have negotiations that are not going well in Geneva, you know, because of the pandemic, right? There was a movement from all countries, not only developing countries, also developed countries, to agree on a convention or a treaty. Or now it's been called an accord, which is a document that countries agree upon, like the drug conventions, the tobacco conventions, and so on, the international health regulations, etc. You know, there are some, it's called binding commitments. So for, I think I'm talking about this because they are complementary to what I was describing for the International Pandemic Preparedness Secretariat.
Right.
Because for that to happen, you know, you need to ensure there is technology transfer, a timely technology transfer. You need to ensure there is the management of intellectual property happens in a manner to protect public health. Mm-hmm. You know, there are several things in this negotiation. It's a member state. It's countries that are negotiating in Geneva. It's not going so well. It's going to be discussed now at the World Health Assembly next month. Mm-hmm. How do you share the pathogens, for example?
Right.
You know, because we saw an unprecedented sharing of information during this pandemic. And we want this to continue next time, right? So let's see what happens.
What's coming up for you specifically for the rest of 2024? I noticed that you're going to be at a few of these regional World Health Summit meetings, and obviously talking about access and health product development. Any other major milestones that we should know about, whether it's the existing organization or some of these other initiatives that you still maintain involvement with? Anything else that I missed while we have you today, please?
You know, I'm part of, because I used to joke when I was younger that I had two major passions in public health. One was HIV, because it deals so much with inequality, inequity, and so on. And the other was mental health. And when I was in WHO, I coordinated internal different departments and things on the drugs. So I'm now part of the International Narcotics Control Board, which is the judicial body of the UN, you know, who actually oversees the application of the drug conventions. You know,
Got it.
for example, the cannabis discussion right now is a big
Sure.
issue, right? Access to narcotic drugs is a big issue. There are many countries who don't access morphine for pain, right? And the crisis with these new psychoactive substances
Man.
that are coming, you know, your own country is going through successive crisis, but it's not only the US, other countries are facing problems as well. You know, so this is the other part of my life this year that's keeping me busy, besides working on the pandemic preparedness, on the issues related to being ready next time, or at least if you're gonna commit mistakes, let's not do the same ones, right?
And hopefully, I noticed that one article from a couple of days ago, where it says, "Look, Mr. President, get the government in order. The one thing we need is a decent government and a ministry of health, and you know that serves the basis for everything." So I'm happy to see that you're sending out the message at all levels that we have to have a focus on these public health issues. And yeah, no, I that's interesting. You brought up mental health and addiction because I did notice, you know, back in Curitiba back in the 80s that you had also written some papers as well on different things that was happening related to mental health and addiction programs at the time. So that's exciting that it comes full circle. It's exciting to say that
Yeah.
yeah, that's a you know it's a major problem for us up here, needless to say. But yeah, no, I'm glad to see that you're also continuing to think about those. No, it's exciting again that you know to hear your journey that you've been on and what you continue to do for public health, not just in Brazil, but obviously through these international organizations that you're still involved in and spreading information, spreading education and knowledge. So no, it's great. And I'm really wishing you and obviously all your team there at the Institute the best with this as you continue with the new organization. Again, for everybody who is going to be listening to this particular episode of our show across the various podcast networks or who will be watching on the YouTube channel. Again, you've been spending time with Dr. Mariangela Simão, Director, President, All for Health Institute or Instituto Tuducipaya South. Mariangela, I really want to thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule to come talk to us for a little while today about what you're up to. Obviously, thank you for what you've been doing and continue to do. And as we like to say on our show, thanks for helping to create a better tomorrow for many people out there via the type of work you do. It's so very important and really wishing you the best with all of it.
Thank you. And one last
Please.
message, because I
Hey.
think it's very important that
Please.
people trust science.
Absolutely.
You know, trust the scientific advancements. So, if your government, your regulatory agency says the vaccine is fit for use, don't hesitate. Do what the health authority tells you to do and trust science.
An extremely important message in this era of unfortunate anti-science movement, but I appreciate you giving that as well. Great having you with us.